This is From the Booth, a podcast sponsored by the International Cinema Program at Brigham Young University. My name is Chip Oskerson, co-director of International Cinema, and I'm joined by fellow co-host and IC co-director, Mark Yamada.
Great to be here.
On the show today, we'll be discussing the first full week of films at International Cinema this fall semester, and we're going to discuss them as if you've seen them, so there won't be any spoiler alerts. You can use the time codes that we provide in the program notes to skip ahead if you need to. Later on, we'll be previewing the films coming up this week at IC. And for those films, we'll give you some things to look for without giving away any important plot points. All right, Mark, I'm here in Paris. You're there in Provo. What's the buzz around 250 of the Kimball Tower?
Well, it was a great kind of kickoff to our first full week of films, headlined by Crazy Rich Asians, which is a little bit of a different film than we usually show at International Cinema, but it was a fun one. It was kind of a good way to make a splash in the beginning of the semester, well attended, really kind of raucous crowds at certain event, at certain showings, apparently.
Raucous and icy are not words that you
usually
go
not.
Together, right?
Yeah, but it was kind of a different crowd, and in some ways, I think it was nice to be able to get maybe some people who don't usually come to International Cinema out to watch this film. It's a film that, you know, has been around for a year or so. It's played in theaters and it's been on DVD, but people were still drawn to it. I think there was something about, you know, the fun, the kind of the rom-com experience that people enjoyed. So that was fun. It was great to be able to kind of temper it, though. And I think we kind of reminded people that we are International Cinema by pairing it with Shoplifters, which is Kore-eda Hirokazu's film from last year, which is really about, in some ways, the opposite socioeconomic experience in Asia, about a family of shoplifters and kind of dealing with the struggles of life and poverty and underclass. I think that was a good way to kind of, you know, I think Saturday night we showed them back to back, and it was, and some people watched both, and it was like they were getting their, you know, their dessert, and then they were getting their vegetables.
With a dose of whiplash.
That's right. That's right.
Well. But I think it's interesting what you're describing, that this is, I think, one of the important functions of something like International Cinema. You can watch Crazy Rich Asians on, I'm sure it's on streaming services now or on DVD on your own. But there's something that comes from watching it with a crowd, and it sounds like people really got into that, which I'm excited to hear about.
They did. These films, they were very different, the four films we showed this week, but I liked how they brought out a different kind of crowd for each film. In Apollo 11, on our Saturday screening, we had Mike Joner from Physics and Astronomy come and talk. And, you know, you really saw a different group of people, people who are really interested in the NASA and the Apollo missions. Double Indemnity brought out students who really were into noir, and some people from TMA came out. And so it was really a great kind of experience to see these different films and the different viewers that they attract.
Right. Well, let's get a little bit deeper into Crazy Rich Asians. So I think this is, like you're saying, something that borders a little bit more on what we might call popular culture. What's the value of showing something like this at International Cinema, do you think?
Yeah, and you know, this is the popular genre. It's something that's very familiar in one sense, right? I mean, it's the plot and the characters, and I think that's what's interesting about it is what you know, I spoke about, I think, on Wednesday, last Wednesday, in my talk on Crazy Poor Asians, is the idea that we're actually seeing, instead of, you know, the normal types of characters that we see in these kind of films, we're seeing minorities, we're seeing people who are not usually depicted. And through that, we're seeing minority characters, a full range of different characters, rather than just kind of filling one kind of stereotypical character, you know, in a film, we're seeing kind of the full range of characters portrayed there. So I think it's not so much maybe the film or what the film's showing, but the way it's showing it and how it's using people that are not usually depicted in this type of genre. So I think that in some ways is the value. It's a film that you kind of have to read against the grain. It's not a film that's terribly deep, or at least on the surface, but I think the implications of the cast and the idea of the diaspora, this kind of experience of Chinese living overseas, are things that raise interest and kind of bring a little bit more of a thinking process to the film.
Sure. I think that's interesting what you're saying, in that think how often in the history of film, the genres that have been used to kind of break the ice, so to speak, are not always the big, heavy-hitting, you know, thought-provoking,
right,
in an obvious kind of way. But a lot of times comedy, you know, and more popular genres are used to, you know, to to start something new, to experiment with something new, because you can kind of hang your hat on the genre. And then afterwards you begin to see, oh, that's actually really significant that we're seeing, you know, this group of people portrayed in this way, or that they're taking on these kinds of roles where we typically, you know, haven't seen that in another kind of mainstream film. Tell us a little bit more about your take on Shoplifters and kind of the work of Corrieta more generally. I was really taken by this film. It just seems so, I think I used this word when we were talking about it in the previews, but just human, right? Yeah. That there's something very humane about his filmmaking. He gets me to think about what it means to be a human and, and in a really essential kind of way.
Yeah, I think the second time, you know, and I think initially we paired these two films because of this kind of socioeconomic distinction between the two. After seeing Shoplifters again, though, I think, and I was kind of going off of what you said last time, this idea of family and what it means to be family. And I think that's kind of what came through for me the second time seeing the film was this idea. And this is a little bit of a spoiler, and I suppose we can kind of give away the ending or a little bit of the information about the film after it's been shown. But, you know, we find out that these people are not actually related. You know, at first they seem like they're family.
Not biologically, at any rate.
They're not biologically related. And I think in some ways, maybe that's what I got from it, was that was really the point, is that, you know, these are people who are together and they stay together, even though there's not those kind of legal things that are keeping together. There's not, you know, the couple in the film is not married legally. They don't, you know, they don't have this relationship, familiar relationship. And there's a line in the film where it talks about choosing family, right? That family is this kind of choosing. And I think that they're not connected, right, by some kind of legal relationship means that they need to kind of constantly choose each other. And I think that was the most poignant thing about the family, was that they were a family and they were constantly choosing to be in each other's lives and to be there for each other. Right.
Right.
That kind of came through. It was a little bit of a, you know, a sense that, you know, just because you're blood and just because you're legally bound to people doesn't necessarily mean that you're kind of developing the kind of relationship that a family is, right? And I think this family demonstrates. It's a difficult film sometimes to swallow, because these people are not, in some ways, they're not really, they're criminals, right? And they're it's hard to really
Well, they're definitely outlaws. They're outside
the law,
right?
And
in so many ways,
and you don't always know their intentions.
But not like gangsters.
Not gangsters,
right? That they're not, it's not glorifying them.
But it's
like society has left them behind somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, they want, and they're also, I mean, they're not totally without, you know, these kind of desires for money, and that, you know, they want money and they're swindlers, and you don't know exactly their motivation sometimes, but there is that's like you said, that kind of humanity that comes through in their relationships. And, you know, and that would really, so the second time I saw it, I drew a little bit more, almost kind of a universal message, right, of family and something that people can relate to. So
yeah, I wonder if, I mean, something that really struck me about them too is the way that they, you know, they choose to be poor in a sense, not in the sense that, of course, I think they would have, you know, liked to have more means, but they choose to stand outside of the things that we're told we're supposed to want to have, right? You know, particularly I'm thinking of consumer culture, and what they're choosing instead are these really close relationships.
Right.
And it does come at a price, right? That they don't live in a standard home. They don't have standard jobs. They, you know, they don't go on vacations in the way that other people go on vacations or whatnot.
Right.
But it's precisely inviting us to see how that's, all of those other things are not what define a family.
Yeah.
What defines a family, I like how you've put that, that they're choosing each other.
Yeah.
In a very real sense, not because biology, you know, kind of forced them to, or, you know, some kind of legal status, but something else.
Yeah.
Is this making a comment, do you think, on contemporary Japanese society, or is it more global culture that Corrieta is talking to, or both?
You know, I think that's the thing with his films, is he's able to do both. Obviously, kind of the message of family is something that resonates with people around the world. And I think he's also speaking, and this is something that, you know, is particular to Japan, or in some ways, not necessarily unique to Japan, but a condition in Japan where adoption and families and things are really based on blood. Adoption doesn't really occur unless there's some kind of blood relationship between the parents and the child. And so this is something that I think he's playing with a little bit. Is it really, you know, blood is so important in Japan and to create family ties, but isn't it really, you know, about the time you spend, the bonds that you build? This is another, this is a theme that he was developing in Like Father, Like Son, a film from a few years ago that deals with kind of a similar idea of, you know, is it the time you spend with people, or is it really the, you know, the blood relationship, the legal, the, you know, the outward things that make you a family? And so I think, like you said, it's really both that he's kind of addressing through this film.
Yeah, that's interesting, because we have a very different idea, I think, in the United States about adoption, that we're much more comfortable with this idea that you could adopt someone that you're not blood related to. So that's helpful context, I think.
Yeah.
Well, one of the other films that we were showing this week was Double Indemnity. And this, of course, is quite different in that it's a film from 1944. And so historical in that sense. And we chose it for the program because it's one of the quintessential film noirs. Of course, it's directed by Billy Wilder. It's based on a serialized novel by James Cain, who's well known for writing in this genre. James Cain's also the author of Mildred Pierce, interestingly enough, that we're going to be showing that film adaptation a bit later in the semester. Also very well known for the book The Postman Always Rings Twice, which some of our listeners might be familiar with. James Cain, though, didn't actually do the adaptation. It was adapted by Billy Wilder, who collaborated with Raymond Chandler. Hmm. And Raymond Chandler's actually an interesting background story, that he lost his job with, oh, I can't remember what kind of company it was, but, you know, turned to writing and started writing this, you know, crime fiction, kind of a popular genre.
Right.
Came to Hollywood to see if he could make it and worked with Billy Wilder. And Billy Wilder typically collaborated with some other people, but was taking a break from them, so to speak. And for 4 months, he worked with Raymond Chandler on the script. And it was a great example of, they were kind of at each other's throats. Right. but at the same time, it created, there was a real productive tension that came mm-hmm. from it. And it's interesting, you know, Billy Wilder was already somewhat established as a filmmaker at this point. So he's the one that has the experience. Right. But Raymond Chandler, I mean, very much to Billy Wilder's credit, I think that he gave Raymond Chandler, he acknowledged how much he learned actually from Raymond Chandler, who didn't have very much experience with film, that he got him to see things about the script. But when the script first came to, that is when the book, when James Cain was originally trying to sell the rights to this book, there were several studios that were interested in it. This is about 10 years before it was actually made. But a letter came from the Hays office, which was the censor's office. The Hays Code, right, was the code that all films had to conform to in Hollywood. Right. And I'll read a little clip from the letter, because I think it's interesting, that they basically wanted to shut it down before the book was acquired,
right.
The rights were acquired. And the letter said, "I am sure you will agree that it is most important to avoid what the code calls, quote, the hardening of audiences, close quote, especially those who are young and impressionable to the thought and fact of crime," right? So it's 10 years later that Billy Wilder picks this up and they rework this and they do actually push this through. But the film is really pushing the envelope. It's one of the first times a Hollywood film explicitly explored the means, motives, and opportunity of committing a murder. Huh. And so it was groundbreaking in that way. It also deals in a very frank way with adultery.
Right.
And this is all, you know, kind of taboo still at the time. But in 1944, of course, there's big changes that are happening in American society, not the least of which is because of World War II. So that's kind of the context of this. And I like film noir. I like these characters that are complex, that have this kind of depth. It's not all simple black and white.
Right.
Although it is black and white, right? I mean, the aesthetic is black and white, but the characters are not, that they're all the shades of gray in between. And it's growing out of German expressionism from the 1930s. It's growing out of the gangster movies that were very popular at this time too. And you get these very sympathetic anti-heroes that in one way or another kind of find themselves on the edge of society.
Right.
And I think that there's a way that continues to resonate with our way of thinking, still today.
Yeah, no, complex characters. Professor Carl Cederholm did our kind of post-screening discussion on the film. and talked about Noor a little bit, and then also mentioned the alternate endings, or I guess the original endings that were cut, and I think probably were there to kind of push the envelope a little bit, but apparently showing the execution in the gas chambers.
Yeah, Walter Neff is actually put in the execution gas chamber.
That's right.
And which is interesting, the book ends with a double suicide. That clearly is off the table, right, according to the production code. And there is this alternate ending. I mean, that has to be cut. I mean, you do have to show with the Hays Code, crime has to be punished, right? That's one of the essential elements of it. And I mean, in some ways, this is the ultimate punishment of crime, but it was seen to be too over the top. And so they had to redo it.
Yeah.
But I think that it's interesting that one of the ways that Billy Wilder recasts the novel is by having the main character narrate the whole thing for us, right? And so at the very beginning of the film, we actually see the end of the film, right? We see him wounded, coming back to the office, pull out the dictaphone, and he starts narrating all of this, which adds this really interesting double layer to the film, because you have both his commentary on what has happened as well as it showing what has happened. Yeah. And he's not an unreliable narrator, but there is this kind of disjunction that I think in some ways is trying to soften the blow for us, because he realizes how off the rails he got in falling for this lady and trying to kill, or not trying to kill, and killing the husband and trying to get away with it.
Yeah. What is the name of his friend there?
Keys.
Keys is
played by Edward Robinson.
And
he's the moral compass, right?
He is. And he's the voice of reason and kind of narrating to Keys, right? Almost a confession of what he had done and in some ways the punishment he deserves. And so, really interesting voiceover.
Yeah. So I think something to keep our eye on as this series develops over the course of the semester is to continue watching the style. Now, how is this all accomplished, right? Kind of stylistically, these interesting uses of dark shadow, light on the screen. I think that this is the signature style of film noir, but as well this kind of complexity in the motivations of characters. What, are they good? Are they bad? Where do our affiliations lie? I mean, at a certain point that we're wanting the main character to get away with this, and then we kind of catch ourselves saying, why why do we want him to be able to be successful in this crime and her for that matter? I think that the representation of women is interesting as well, that we have a woman who in Barbara Stanwyck, and she's one of the actors that really helps to carry this whole film.
Right.
But, the agency of women is really limited here in these films. And we're going to see some later ones where they kind of turn some of this on its head and they get us to rethink a little bit that, why are women cast in the way they are originally? Is this articulating some kind of crisis of masculinity that was maybe experienced as men were coming home from the war, having had these experiences that were difficult to articulate, difficult to fit back into society? Women have taken on jobs that men, had traditionally had. And so is this a way of trying to navigate, some of that in some ways? Our last film from the week was Apollo 11. This is our documentary, kind of stands outside the themes that we've started, the series that we've been talking about in some ways, but a pretty spectacular film. And I think seeing it on the big screen is the only way to see this film properly.
Yeah, it's true. And it's shown, I think it was streaming on the CNN site and some other places, but this is really the way to see it. And people who had seen it before and saw it again, I see said as much, that you really have to see it on the big screen. And you miss details. There are little things in some of the footage that you'll actually miss watching it like on a smaller screen. So really spectacular film and great Q&A that we had on Saturday with Mike Joner from Physics.
Well, and one of the things that you miss too watching on a small screen is the sound. And, watching that Saturn V rocket take off and feeling it, right? It becomes a visceral, kind of experience. To make this film, they had to comb through 11,000 hours of audio recording and hundreds of hours of film material that they spliced together. And I think that the editing is just, obviously what makes this film, that they put together something that is visually really stunning. It moves right along. And it's all done through this direct cinema approach. That is, that the film contains no voiceover narration or interviews beyond what was available in the contemporary source material. And I think that that gives it a real power. Yeah. If we'd had kind of a talking head talking through all of this, I think that that it wouldn't have been as effective. It wouldn't have put you in the moment in quite the same way.
No, that's for sure. It would feel a little bit like it's history, like it's been documented, and here you're kind of experiencing it again. Yeah.
You know, almost as it unfolds, right? Yeah. Okay, well, these are the films that ran last week. Now we'll take the opportunity to preview the films that are going to be coming up in the coming week. The films, I'll go through the names now, and then we'll go through them briefly one by one. We're showing Icebox, a film by Daniel Sokka in Spanish and English from 2018. M by Fritz Lang, a German film from 1931. Columbus by Koganada, an English film, English language film, that is, an American film from 2017. And a documentary this week is Bauhaus Spirit, 100 Years of Bauhaus. Let's start with Icebox real quickly. Daniel Sokka is an interesting young director. This is a remake of a short that he made a couple years ago. And what's really interesting, it's kind of a rip from the headlines kind of story. It's a story of a Honduran boy played by Anthony Gonzalez, who's incidentally the lead voice in the movie Coco. But he's forced to join a gang in Honduras. And so his family, in order to protect him, sends him north, right? And he has to illegally cross the border. He's apprehended at the border, and that's then he's put into a detention facility. That's where the this idea of Icebox, that's what they call the cells that they put the miners in. And he made this actually before the separation policy under the current administration really hit the headlines. So all of this was, he was kind of working through. And I think it's fortunate because there's a way in which, for maybe good reasons or bad, that immigration services themselves have really been villainized in some of the stories lately. And this is something that struck me about the film. And I think it's something you pointed out to me when you first saw it at Sundance, is that the movie doesn't do that. The movie focuses much more on the experience of the boy, and the immigration officials around them, they're very much trying to do their best and do their job, but they also recognize the limitations of things.
And they're overwhelmed, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The realities of it.
So I think that the thing that's really interesting about this film is it gives some depth and dimension to things that we see going on in the news. I mean, I think it does it in a somewhat balanced way. It really, of course, invites us to see the situation through the eyes of the immigrants and the refugees, or the asylum seekers, whatever you'd like to call them, and the difficult predicament that they're in. A good question to think about is, how will this film age? Is this going to only be interesting because we're in this moment? Once this current crisis passes, we hope it passes, is this going to seem is interesting to us? I think one of the real highlights is the performance actually of Gonzalez, though. He really plays this role incredibly well. I dare say he's the strongest actor in the entire film.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Yes. And it's a difficult role to play, but he does it very convincingly. And it really, helps you to think about, okay, what are the ethical things that we need to think about in this situation?
Right.
The other film that I'll mention just briefly is M. This is, again, it's a historical film insofar that it's made in 1931 by Fritz Lang. And Fritz Lang is one of the great German directors from the 20s and 30s in Germany. He emigrates to the United States, where he goes on to have a fairly successful career in Hollywood. This is his first sound film from 1931. It's a good example of late Weimar cinema. There's a lot of elements in M that's going to create this movement, this genre. Later on, that's called by the French critics film noir. Part, it's him and Billy Wilder and others coming over from Europe in the 30s and 40s that bring this style with them. It's based on the life of a real life serial killer. And he really creates some interesting cinema through his use of sound, through his use of editing. The sound, something that I think that people can watch for as they're experiencing this film, is how sound plays with presence and absence. And it might seem a little bit primitive how he's using it. I don't know if it's that he didn't totally have control yet of sound, or if he just really is trying things that we just don't do anymore. I mean, there's parts of the film that just go silent, but it creates this interesting effect. And so pay attention to where, when you hear things but don't see them, or where you see things but don't hear them, that this is actually, I think, fairly important. He also uses editing in a really creative way to set up these interesting parallels. And in this case, this murderer is on the loose, and the gangsters in the underworld have every bit as much motivation to find him as does the police. And so they're both competing with each other to find the culprit first. And he uses editing to really set up these parallel between police and the gangsters. And of course, this is early 30s Germany. Lung knows exactly what he's talking about, that he very much sees the rise of the Nazis as a bunch of murderous thugs and that are taking official power. And so he's making some interesting statements about what justice is, and he's getting us to think about what mob rule is and how justice and mob rule are at odds with each other, or how they go hand in hand with each other at times. So this, I think that viewers are going to see that this film has aged incredibly well. When I teach the German Scandinavian cinema class, this is one of the films that always gets some of the highest ratings from the students in terms of films that they saw as really valuable. So I really encourage people to see M if they haven't already seen this.
Well, that's great.
Tell us a little bit about Columbus.
Yeah, so Columbus is, and we're doing a little bit of a kind of a mini series on architecture here this week. So we have Bauhaus Spirit and Columbus. Columbus is by, as you mentioned, director Kogo Nada a few years ago. And it deals with, ostensibly it's a story about a man played by John Cho, whose father is this famous architect, and his father falls into a coma while visiting Columbus, Indiana, which is home to several works of modernist architecture.
Surprisingly, this little town in Indiana.
Who would have thought, but a really beautiful town and beautiful architecture. And so the character played by John Cho befriends a young girl who has this passion for architecture and is in some ways kind of stuck in her own life. She's stuck in this small town, and John Cho's character is kind of stuck there as well. And so they develop a friendship and have experiences dealing with kind of architecture. And I mean, something that I think is really good and something to look forward to in this film and to look for in this film is the way in which the film uses architecture. And it doesn't just use it as kind of a set piece or a theme, but really this idea of architecture and film kind of coming together here a little bit as, a way of kind of constructing space. And I think the film does a really great job through its kind of beautiful compositions of, in some ways, kind of reflecting the way in which architecture gives form and shape to the space around us. And I think that's something to look forward to in this film is what role architecture plays in the lives of these two characters and how it kind of gives shape to their life. What's really great about this film is it's a drama, and there are things that happen, and there's kind of a humanity about it, and we can definitely relate to the characters, but it's very muted at the same time. And I think in another director's hands, it could come off as really melodramatic. Pay attention to the way that he kind of mutes the emotion in some ways.
When it becomes more about space then, right?
It does, yeah. And the way the characters kind of interact within it. And in some ways relates to Bauhaus Spirit, which is the documentary we'll be showing this week. This is a really interesting documentary. It's the 100-year anniversary of Bauhaus, which is a movement. It's a design school. It's a movement. It's a style of the art that developed around 1919 in Germany, founded by Walter Gropius, who is a well-known architect. And just a little bit of background on Bauhaus. I mean, it was really this grand, almost utopian movement of trying to find kind of a very modernist impulse in finding a totality for the arts. It was about breaking down boundaries between architecture and dance and drama and visual design and technology and lifestyle and really thinking about space and how we use space and then designing buildings around it. So there's a certain practical element to it that kind of keeps it from being too kind of high-minded. And I really appreciate that about this documentary. You'll pay attention to the way in which, we're dealing with these ideas of abstraction, but then they become more concrete through attention to kind of city planning, of school design, of using these ideas in very practical ways. There's a really great sequence about that kind of relates in some ways to the tiny house movement that's been going on recently, in response to maybe the housing crisis, environmental concerns. And so it, in some ways, it's ahead of its time. It's very visionary, and it's taking a very kind of interesting almost utopian kind of artistic movement, and then showing how it has practical application to things that affect us every day. So,
well, and kind of global implications. I really like how they go all over the world,
right,
to trace through, like, how is Bauhaus still relevant today? Like, you know, what are some of the things it's influenced and affected?
Yeah. So these films, in that way, work well together in dealing with space and how we kind of represent space and move through space, and really interesting couple of films.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for being part of our discussion today on From the Booth. Our podcast is produced by the International Cinema Program, who gets its unfaltering support from the BYU College of Humanities. The hosts of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they do not necessarily represent any official position adopted by the university or its supporting institutions. We thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, as well as the staff at the BYU Humanities Resource Center and Humanities College web team for their help and support. Until next week, we hope to see you in 250 of the Kimball Tower. Thanks, Mark.
See you next time.